It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The rate of autism has grown dramatically. The CDC estimates 1 in 59 children has some form of autism. That's created a growing need for schools specializing in the education of kids along the autism spectrum. Construction is continuing on the new Presley Ridge School for Autistic Children in the Pittsburgh region, which is scheduled to open in time for the 2019-20 school year. Suzanne Cole is the president and CEO of Presley Ridge, and she joins us now. Suzanne, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Presley Ridge dates back to the 1830s, and its services have grown and expanded over the decades. So how does this new school and the teaching of children with autism fit into that mission?
So Presley Ridge began serving students in the 60s in different educational settings across Pennsylvania. And as we were serving those students, we started to receive students that had special needs in the form of autism. So in our schools, we had some classrooms with children with autism in them. And then we decided that as the need continued to grow, that Presley Ridge really needed to open up our own education settings specifically to meet those needs for children with autism in their own school building. So as our mission continues to expand, we're really looking at ways in which we can meet community needs. And with this number of 1 in 59 kids, that need continues to grow. And so we're there to respond.
So would you say that there were shortcomings in, the current facility where the students with autism are being taught? Or is it just the growing demand and here's our chance to further address their needs?
It's really a combination of both. The school buildings are typical school buildings where our children are currently being served. However, children with autism and children that are deaf also have special needs when it comes to the sensory aspects of the autism. And so for us, it's about creating a space that really is conducive to optimal learning for those kids and addressing those sensory needs. But then, as you mentioned, as a number of kids continue to grow, we just need to be present there to be able to help those families and to serve those kids.
So as the mission changed for the organization, as you learn more about autism, whether it's in the setting or the curriculum,
we really try to stay on top of what's happening in the field and to try to be partnering with experts in the field to make sure that we're providing the best possible services. So what I would say is that we're constantly changing to meet the needs. As new evidence comes out, as new interventions come out, Presley Ridge is looking at what can we do to incorporate those into our educational programming for those kids.
Mm-hmm. I know there are some facilities and some mainstream schools for autistic children. So will the students that you teach, will they be all along the autism spectrum or just highly functioning or what?
So mostly the children that we educate at Presley Ridge have significant impairments on the autism spectrum. And so we're partnering with public school districts, but we're serving the kids that public schools don't have the resources to serve. And so we partner with those school districts. They send the children to Presley Ridge, and then we're providing highly individualized, specialized education to children with higher needs on that autism spectrum.
I want to get more into the school itself, the new school. Is there additional training required for your teachers who are already instructing and working with autistic kids in, quote, the regular classrooms?
Yes, so our teachers are all certified special education teachers with a specialization in autism, but then Presley Ridge has its own kind of curriculum that we really work on, a training curriculum with our teachers to ensure that their skill level is enhanced for the children that we're serving.
Mm-hmm. So when you started planning this school on the north side, right?
Yes.
Marshall Avenue?
Yes, Marshall Avenue.
Who did you sound out? I mean, what advice did you get? Where did you get the advice to get the best setting, the best environment of a school for kids with autism?
So we did a lot of research. We have, fortunately, a number of experts within Presley Ridge that have taught children with autism for many, many years. But we also, as I mentioned, partner with people in the community at the local universities. We reach out nationally to people that are experts in autism. We research the materials on space for children with autism. And then we contracted with two experts in the field to really work with our architects locally to design a space that's conducive to learning for these children. So it's been a lot of research, a lot of effort, a lot of conversations with experts, and then using people to really inform our decisions on this building.
Let's face it, some of the best experts can be the parents themselves. So did you include them in the conversation of what their kids would need?
So we actually had we had parent groups, parent feedback, but then fortunately for us, the consultant that we're using has a child with autism, and her profession is she's an architect. So she has the best of both worlds. She understands the needs of her own son who has autism, and then of course her profession is architecture. And so it's been a nice marriage of parents informing us and then working with experts who have a really clear understanding of what we need.
I want to talk about the school, but I also want to talk a little bit more about the role of families in this case, so for the autistic children. Does the approach reflect the overall goal of supporting families and sort of, I guess, helping families thrive, alleviate some of the stress of everyday life, if you would?
Yes, I absolutely believe so. I mean, our mission is whatever it takes to create success for children and families. So families are core to what we do. And I don't think people really realize that when you have a child with any type of a disability or a challenge, that parents are stressed in their everyday activity. So just going to the grocery store can be stressful. Going out in public can be stressful sometimes because you don't know if your child is going to act out or if they're going to have a reaction to something and get upset. And so what we try to do is work with the families, work with the community, find ways in which to help integrate children into the community and to get a better understanding of the general public for what these families have to deal with. So even though we're providing educational services to children, we are also working in their homes, in their communities, with their families all along the way to really help, as you mentioned, alleviate the stress of just sending their child to school, but also making those skills transferable to community. So our schools are really designed to not only teach academics, but daily living skills. We go on outings. We create spaces that allow the kids to interact with different people, even in the community, and we invite the community in, as well as taking, as I mentioned, the children out. But we really want this interaction so that we can help alleviate whatever stress, whatever behavioral issues the kids are facing.
So less stress can equal greater stability?
Absolutely. Absolutely, for everyone in the family.
All right, we mentioned school will be located on Marshall Avenue. Tell us about the building's features. How will this be a better physical setting for the kids?
We're really excited for the school. So the school is a 40,000 square foot building. And the important thing to note, though, is that the physical setting, as I mentioned, is sensory friendly. And so there will be lighting that is specialized to meet the needs. So it's not this fluorescent buzzing lighting that, you know, you might find in office buildings or even in traditional school buildings. You can adjust the lighting so it can get lower if you need to calm the classroom down a little bit, or you can brighten it up if you need to do that. There will be special flooring that will help with the noise and the sound. Kids are very sensitive to things that are loud when you have autism, and so we want to make sure that the space is quiet and calming as much as it can possibly be. So you'll see carpet tiles, and you'll see different things on the walls that help the sound to be a little bit muffled. So different things like that, along with some really creative things in the school, like there will be a specialized lab for learning, exploring career skills, vocational skills, and then integrating those back into the community. There'll be a culinary classroom that helps teach kids how to cook, a coffee shop to learn how to interact with people. So just some really cool things. And all of those items in the school will really help integrate kids back into the community while also paying attention to their sensory needs in that setting.
So there are features, attributes to sort of avert the negative reaction, but there are also some features to sort of accentuate positive reaction within the students?
Absolutely. It's a balance. So, you know, we're trying to help the students learn to their optimal potential. So having the special lighting, the special flooring, the way to mute the sound a little bit allows us the ability to really teach and to help the kids as they're working in the coffee shop or they're, you know, learning to cook. So it's really a combination of both.
And it's not always, I guess, acting out, as you said. It's also the distraction factor, which could, you know, lead to, well, lack of focus on what they're supposed to try, what they're supposed to be learning, you know, the teacher trying to teach.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. I did want to ask you, how many students will be enrolled in this new school?
So this school has the capacity for 80 students total.
And some of your current students who are, where's your current facility where they learn?
Yeah, our current facility is on Marshall Avenue. So, okay. So 40 of those students will transfer over to this school. So we've got 40 new desks available for children to attend.
Are you concerned that you said that you can accommodate 80? Are you concerned that those numbers we cited at the beginning of our conversation are going to keep growing, the needs growing? Are you concerned about that and how Presley Ridge might play a role in trying to meet that?
Well, I'm always concerned when I see numbers growing as they are, especially in autism. And I'm really hoping that there are more supports for early intervention so that children can get the help early on. But we design our schools to be more like community schools. We don't want children traveling hours on a bus to be educated. So we have schools, five different schools in Pennsylvania in various locations, and we try to keep the kids close to home. So we're serving children within an hour radius from 32 different school districts. And that's because we also understand that those bus rides can be, stressful for kids.
Right.
So now I'm confident we can meet the need. And if we need to grow and change in the future, I'm sure we'll adapt and do that as well. But I really, want to focus on these community local schools.
Right. So as the school gets closer and closer, what are you most excited about as that building gets closer to opening?
I'm excited to show the kids and their families. I mean, the families are so excited to come tour the school. I'm excited for the opportunity for the kids to be in a space that's solely theirs, designed to meet their needs. I'm excited to see them interacting with all the sensory equipment that we'll have in the classrooms and in some of the specialized sensory rooms. So I'm just excited to be able to provide them a space that allows for them to be not only happy, but stress-free and in a place where they can really optimize their learning and education.
And finally, what's next for Presley Ridge?
I have no idea, but we are there to meet the needs of the community. So whatever is next, we'll be ready for it.
And that can be an example of a variety of services you already offer, maybe an expansion?
Absolutely, yes. I think that, Presley Ridge will pay attention to what's happening with the opioid epidemic, and I think that we'll be responsive there. So if I had to nail down one thing, I think that's an area in which we are going to try to assist and help however we can.
Suzanne Cole is the president and CEO of Presley Ridge. Their new school for autistic children is to open for the new school year. Suzanne, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. At the center of the government shutdown is President Trump's proposed steel border wall. Trump argues it's a growth opportunity for steel companies, but those same companies are caught up in the shutdown. Then, last fall, the Department of Corrections adopted several security measures to stop the flow of drugs into prisons. Included in those measures were restrictions on book gifts and reading materials. But after pushback, officials eased those restrictions. Coming up, a conversation on access to books by inmates. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at WESA.FM.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A group of abortion providers is suing Pennsylvania, saying the procedure should be covered by Medicaid. They argue that the state not covering abortions is a violation of the Equal Rights Amendment, since they can be an important part of women's health care. And some local utilities and banks are working with furloughed federal employees who are having trouble paying bills. PWSA is waiving late fees, while Duquesne Light and First Energy are offering payment plans. PNC and Dollar Bank are also working with customers who are federal employees. Find more online at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Along the 10th Street Bypass and Allegheny Riverfront Trail, large metal rings are fixed to retaining walls. As 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports for our Good Question series, they're a throwback to the days when the rivers were crowded with commercial ships and barges that passed through Pittsburgh.
Good Question listeners Mike Ignema and Stuart Williams notice them along the Allegheny River as they travel around the city.
There are sets of rings, and they are spaced about every 50 yards as you go down the 10th Street bypass.
I'm wondering if they're for decorative purposes or if they actually have a purpose at all.
There are actually two different sets of rings that they're referring to. There are a series of giant ones attached to columns along the Allegheny River near the point, and there are trios of smaller ones lining the 10th Street bypass. Both are a nod to the area's past as a commercial hub.
The rivers were what brought everything to Pittsburgh.
That's Pittsburgh history buff Tim Kilmeyer. He says the Allegheny Wharf was a center for industrial traffic, whereas the Monongahela Wharf was mostly used for commerce and social gatherings.
Just like everybody would go to Point State Park today, and if they feel Point State Park, everybody went to the Mon Wharf to celebrate Pittsburgh stuff.
In the early 1900s, Pittsburgh's population nearly doubled to more than 500,000. Steelworks, brickyards, and train tracks lined the rivers, and barges and freight ships docked nearby to transport products. As automobiles became more common, drivers would park along the rivers. There was no barrier between the water and the land, like a beach. It was a dense environment, and space was running out. So on the Allegheny River side of the city, developers needed a way to route traffic around downtown.
Let's use the wharf, and we'll build a bypass on the wharf. And that's what they came up with.
Construction began on what was then known as the Duquesne Way Project, a route parallel to the rail lines leading from the Point to the Strip District. But a persistent issue challenged the builders.
There's always been flooding.
Duquesne Way was frequently inundated by the rising Allegheny River. So as workers finished what would become the 10th Street Bypass, barges or passing boats would tie to the rings on the bypass's retaining wall to keep from drifting away. The bypass still floods, but ships no longer use the rings. They've been a lot harder to access since the Allegheny Riverfront Trail was built between the bypass and the river in the late 1990s. That trail is where several even larger rings are attached to concrete columns. Gateway Clipper fleet owner Terry Wergenis says those rings were installed when the wharfs were still bustling. His family's fleet used to tie to them during high water conditions.
Well, like in Hurricane Agnes in 1972, the water came almost all the way up to the surface of the parkway, so we were tied to those ring buoys.
But beyond those rare instances, they aren't really used. The rings are not part of an old lock system, as some have speculated. While they're not used for their original purpose anymore, they're still popular among passing kids who love to jump and try to swing from them. Ultimately, they're a reminder of the region's rich history of river commerce. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
You can find other stories in our Good Question series at WESA.fm. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. At the center of the government shutdown is President Trump's proposal for a steel border wall. Trump pitched it as a big opportunity for steel companies. But as 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins explains, while the proposal promises growth for the industry, steel was caught in the shutdown, too.
The Edgar Thompson Steel Mill in Braddock is the only mill left in the Pittsburgh region that's capable of taking raw iron ore and turning it into finished steel. Back in 2016, Donald Trump pledged to help the steel industry with economic policies that would build new mills in western Pennsylvania and across the country. Manufacturing employment has increased, but the government shutdown and the border wall that's at the heart of it may have impacts of their own.
Listen, if I build a wall and the wall is made out of steel instead of concrete, I think people will like that.
That was Trump earlier this month during the government shutdown.
And here's the other good thing. I'll have it done by the United States Steel Corporation, by companies in our country that are now powerful, great companies again. And they become powerful over the last 2 years because of me and because of our trade policies.
Not surprisingly, the steel industry supports the president's choice of building materials.
Steel is the right material to make such a barrier. It's durable, strong, and steel is readily available.
Tom Gibson is the president of the American Iron and Steel Institute. He's familiar with designs for a steel wall. So how would the proposal impact the industry? Here come the numbers. American steel companies produce somewhere between 90 and 100 million tons of steel a year. And Gibson says a 1,000-mile-long border wall would require 3 million tons of steel, an order he says the industry would love to fill. But
the reality of it is the impact is going to be relatively minor.
John Packard is the president and CEO of Steel Market Update, an industry publication. He says because the wall could take years to build, companies won't need to open a lot of new steel mills.
It's not like going out to Home Depot and buying a wire fence and sticking it in your yard and next day you have it. This is more of a months, years long process. then the impact on the industry becomes less and less critical.
Meanwhile, another Trump policy, a 25% tariff on imported steel, is already having an impact. The tariffs help U.S. Steel, which owns the Edgar Thomson Works in Braddock. But other American manufacturers that rely on imports have had to apply for tariff exemptions. That application process is at a standstill because of the shutdown. So the border wall could help the industry, but the shutdown it's caused has hurt other metal manufacturers.
I had a conversation with the CEO of a company that had filed for an exclusion almost a year ago, and his attorneys were telling him that they should get a response during the month of January, and I have to assume at this particular point it's now going to be sometime in February. So there's another month gone by that he's in limbo.
Kerry Trito teaches economics at the University of Pittsburgh and says if the wall gets built, tariffs will cost taxpayers too.
So here we go. Here's the quantity of steel. Here's our price of steel.
She draws a graph to explain how Trump's tariffs also raise the price for steel made in the U.S.
One of the things that people often misunderstand about tariffs is they assume that the tariffs will only raise the price of imported steel. But tariffs raise the price of the product both domestically and from the imported sources.
That means if a steel border wall is built, it will cost American taxpayers more than if the tariffs were never put in place. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Hey, it's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Downtown Community Development Corporation announced Wednesday that 9 venues will add music or expand existing offerings. That announcement, part of the CDC's ongoing Music City Downtown initiative, meant to improve experiences for residents and visitors alike. That's according to the group's executive director, John Valentine. Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Bill, thanks for coming in.
Sure thing.
All right. Bill, a perpetual criticism in some circles of Pittsburgh is that there just aren't enough places to hear good live music around here. How's this initiative trying to change that?
Well, they're working with the downtown CDC is working with local venues, specifically downtown, to try to get them to either expand offerings that they already have at places like Backstage Bar and August Wilson Center, and also getting some places that don't currently have live music to add it.
Mm-hmm. And so new venues altogether or just venues that are there but don't already have music?
Yeah, more the latter. They're not building any new buildings for music or creating places specifically to house music, but they're adding it to the programming, so there'll be more stuff to do downtown.
Anything special about the additions, new features to improve that listening experience?
Yeah, well, like the Market Street Grocery right on Market Square there is actually adding a second floor venue. It's above the grocery itself. Mm-hmm. So that'll be actually a new place to hear music downtown. Velazzi's Restaurant is retrofitting its wine cellar. Like I said, as a new wine cellar, mm-hmm. and they're going to be playing music down there too.
Mm-hmm. Part of this initiative, was it to assess demand? So there must be a demand if they're asking for expansion.
Well, John Valentine of the Pittsburgh Downtown CDC says they hear this complaint a lot from visitors, from residents. Of course, there's many more residents downtown than there used to be just a few years ago. He says they hear this a lot. There's not enough places to hear music. And so they started working a few years ago, actually, to make this happen.
That leads us to the types of music. What types might benefit? Some venues might cater to specific communities of artists. Will this help everyone in the music scene?
I don't know about everyone, but they're talking right now about sort of acoustic music. So your singer-songwriter type stuff might be more opportunities for folks like that. They're talking about jazz, blues, kind of more, you know, traditional offerings, I guess you would say, like that. They might expand a little bit in the future.
Bill, how would you think that this addition, these additions, fit into the larger effort by the city to expand its music ecosystem, make it more business friendly to the local artists and those in town who are just visiting for a night or two?
Right. Well, there is the Music Ecosystem Project, which the WESA sister station YEP is involved in. This is separate. It's sort of complementary to that, but it's a separate initiative from that. I think from the point of view, something we hear from artists a lot is that performers, not a lot of places to play, apparently. So if we do have this demand, people who want to hear more live music and people who want to play it but can't find places, having more venues seems like it would be a no-brainer to help fill that gap.
And final quick question, is there sort of a time frame, a timetable, when they'd like this to take place?
Sure, as soon as possible. The Pittsburgh Downtown CDC says as soon as February, we could start to see the first bookings from this. I don't know if you'll notice a big difference yet. It might take a while for sort of the critical mass to build up for all these venues to come online and start increasing their offerings. But maybe as soon as February, the first fruits of this will be born.
All right, Bill, we'll look for the expansions and we'll listen for the music. Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure thing, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. After more than two dozen staffers at state prisons became sick from exposure to synthetic drugs, the Department of Corrections adopted several security measures to stop the flow of drugs into prison. Those restrictions impacted how inmates received mail and even books from the outside, paper items that could be embedded with some synthetic drugs. Well, after pushback from inmates advocates and book donors, corrections officials amended those restrictions. We're going to talk about books, reading materials, and inmates with Jody Lincoln, one of the co-organizers of Book'em, an organization that works to get free books to inmates. Welcome to The Confluence, Jody.
Thanks so much for having me.
So originally, the Department of Corrections restrictions on books coming from the outside, they wanted to get a handle on how the drugs, synthetic drugs, were getting into prison. Was there an issue with that from Book'em's perspective?
No. And according to the DOC, there wasn't an issue with our organization and other organizations sending books and drugs being in them either. They had a couple of instances where they had books that people had purchased in bookstores and sent directly to inmates where drugs had been put in the pages, but there was no evidence that any of the Books to Prisoners free donation organizations had been putting drugs and getting them into prisons.
Yeah, so it came in a book, but it's like, okay, we're going to look at all books or scrutinize all books. All right. So in early November, after some pushback, as I said, that those restrictions were eased. So are you satisfied with those, the easing of restrictions?
We're still navigating the new system. Now, instead of sending the books directly to the people who are incarcerated at their individual prisons, books are all getting sent to a security processing center in central PA in Bellefonte, where the DOC is doing a drug screening and then sending books to the individual SCIs. Has the potential to work really well. First couple months, there's been a large backup. It's been taking weeks for people to get their books. We have some concerns over how the process actually works and how they're paying for everything. But we're working with the DOC in the implementation of the new procedure.
Okay, let's talk about the process, Book'em. So how does it work? Most, if not all, nearly all of the books you get are donated, correct?
Yeah, probably 98% of the books we get are donated from individuals in the city, just dropping them off at the Thomas Merton Center. Sometimes we'll go to people's houses and fill a car. We also have some great relationships with bookstores or publishers that donate us things like their advanced reader copies and things like that.
So give us an idea. Are these books, so you get these donated books, and you just ship them off to a prison, the system, or is there one-on-one, shall we say, interaction with inmates?
Yeah, so the people who are incarcerated actually write us directly requesting books. We get hundreds and hundreds of letters a month. We do get letters from across the country, but we only serve Pennsylvania. And in these letters, the people request what they want. we hope for genres, but sometimes people are asking for specific books or authors, and we try to fill their needs as closely as we can. We have an awesome library set up in the basement of the Thomas Merton Center. We have thousands and thousands of books, so after reading the letters, people go out and try to, you know, get a nice collection of about 3 books that we send out.
So if you can't match that very specific request, you try for something, you know what, if you like that or you think you like this, you might very well like this.
Exactly, yeah. There's often a Googling of who is this author, you know, we're not familiar with them, what do they write? All right, let's try to find something that is pretty similar.
Now, when before these restrictions, so you got a request, you say, aha, we have it, and you shipped it directly to the prison where the person was incarcerated, correct? And then they got the book to the particular individual. Is there any issue? You mentioned the delay, but other than the delay, are they still getting the books that they requested?
They've started to, the processing center, as of a couple weeks ago, I heard from the DOC, had processed a couple thousand books so far, still had a backlog of a few thousand packages. They had us starting to send books to them before they were up and running, so they had rooms full of books that they needed to get through.
I get a question. So you get the initial request from the inmates. Do you get feedback from them, say, hey, I really like that book. Do you have anything else that might be of interest to me?
Yeah, definitely. Well, we fill requests for people every 3 months is how often we're able to serve people. So oftentimes we have people writing us regularly every 3 months, right? They get their quarterly shipments. So we definitely get feedback. We also do audits every once in a while. We're starting audit next week, actually sending out letters to people asking for their feedback, kind of sussing out this new system, seeing how it's working for them. Also, when the ban went into place in September, we did an extensive outreach to everyone we'd served in the past year, thousands of people, trying to get their firsthand account of what Bookum had meant to them and also how these new policies were affecting them and negatively impacting their experience in the inside.
In our last minute, I'd like to ask you a broader question. How do you assess your role, Bookum's role, in trying to help prisoners better themselves by reading, by learning?
Yeah, so reading is and education is an essential part of decreasing recidivism and being able to integrate yourself back into society. We get tons of requests. Biggest request is for dictionaries, people literally trying to, you know, learn how to read and write and better communicate themselves. We send out tons of trade books, employment and job training and self-help books, everything from, you know, addiction to learning, you know, just how to relate to people better. So being able to spend the time when you are incarcerated to educate yourself and become, you know, more well-rounded person is essential for reintegration into society.
And the quick follow-up is this. So you're hoping that this learning while in prison might lessen the chance for maybe recidivism or want to continue learning once they're back in society.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jody Lincoln is a co-organizer of Bookum. That's an organization that works to get free books to inmates in Pennsylvania's prisons. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence. As we observe Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday, groups across Pittsburgh are doing the work that Reverend King often spoke about. One such group is Repair the World, their Pittsburgh chapter, holding a discussion this weekend to look at the historical inequities in Pittsburgh area schools. Joining me to talk about the work of Repair the World Pittsburgh is the executive director, Zach Block. Zach, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Hosting a dinner, talk about, if you would, to talk about the inequity among Pittsburgh area schools. So how did this event come together?
Yeah, so actually we're hosting about 10 events over the course of the next, between today and Monday.
Okay.
The dinner is the kickoff. It's tonight. It's at the shop in Homewood. We have over 100 people registered for tonight. We have some great partners around that: Higher Achievement, A-plus Schools, the Homewood Children's Village, Strong Women, Strong Girls. So feel free to come out tonight. We have a local caterer, Jackie Page Heidelberg, and we'll have hopefully a good discussion around desegregation in Pittsburgh public schools and then how to activate people to actually start serving in the community.
Right. I think you might have, but I'll say, why did you think this is necessary?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of disparity in the world, right? It's amazing how we think about the systemic inequalities and inequities out there. And if we don't talk about it, people aren't going to know about it. A lot of us live in a bubble where we remain outside of that knowledge. And if we can make some people aware and affect them in some way, then hopefully they'll start serving and working towards systemic change.
All right. You mentioned Pittsburgh Public Schools, city schools. What are you hoping people come away with? What they maybe start talking about amongst themselves and broadening the discussion after that discussion?
I mean, truthfully, it's I want them to understand about this disparity that exists. Like, sometimes we talk about it within a regional perspective, but even within PPS itself, and not that folks there aren't trying to do, you know, a good job and that they're whatever, but, you know, we have a school, a city school like Alderdice. It offers, a few years ago, the numbers were 29 AP classes for kids, and then you have another city school like Westinghouse, so same district, just a couple miles from one another. Westinghouse was offering, I believe, 3 AP classes for its students. Mm-hmm. There was an article in the Post-Gazette a few years ago. A student came forward where he hadn't had a full-time science teacher for the course of the whole year. Like, how do we expect kids to succeed if the opportunities aren't the same across the board? Mm-hmm. And what do we do about that to change that and move that so that they are?
All right. So part of what is looked at in the talks, the model of education, magnet schools, the differences between charter and public schools. How do you decide on the specific issues to talk about?
Yeah. So every, you know, we have a cohort of fellows who are doing a year of service with us. And between them and the folks who they want to, who we're serving with, like our partners in this, Higher Achievement, A+, et cetera, we come up with the topic together. We create the content around the dinner tonight together. We'll facilitate the dinner together. So everybody's contributed content towards the guide for tonight that people will follow. Mm-hmm. And have these discussions at the small tables at the dinner tonight.
About how many people are you expecting or hoping for?
Well, right now over 100 are signed up. I'm a little concerned about the weather, but I still expect a good turnout.
It'll be tomorrow when it hits the weather. Yeah. Our final minute, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Westinghouse. You mentioned the dinner. We have to mention that features dishes by Westinghouse culinary students.
Yes, that is part of it. We have their culinary program are actually making the appetizers for tonight. And then Jackie Paige Heidelberg is doing the entree, the main dish for everybody.
All right. They might be so wrapped up in the food that they forget to talk. No, they won't.
No, I hope not. That's what we'll have facilitators at every table to make sure that the conversations happen and that the goal is activation around these issues afterwards. So.
And how can people find out more information quickly?
They can go to www.werepair.org and then /Pittsburgh and look for the events on our website page.
All right. Zach Block is the executive director of Repair the World Pittsburgh. Zach, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. At this time on Monday, a special program for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And Tuesday on The Confluence, Evolving STEM, using science and lab experiments, to better teach students about evolution. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, plus Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.